This may be my favorite part of the game. Plain Lies of P is like climbing the mountain, with angry goats lurking behind every rock, nook and cranny. The goats get angrier the higher you climb, while the paths get steeper and the bridges weaker. Every now and then you come across a giant goat blocking your path. This one introduces himself in dramatic fashion, but you're not really paying attention. You're too busy preparing your big bag of rocks. The goat charges. You keep your distance and throw a few rocks their way. That only makes them madder. You run further away and keep on with the rocks until they explode. You breathe a sigh of relief. You set up your tent and rest. You look forward to the next section of the climb. If not for the goats, then at least for the scenery. That scenery is impressive. There's Belle Epoque architecture, inspired by late 19th century Parisian design and other European structures from this era. There's a vertigo-inducing cathedral interior, its exterior an imposing Gothic facade flanked by strange winged statues. Then there's the grungier locations, including an open swamp area littered with piles of flattened puppets, a puppet-making factory filled with rusted machinery, heavy industry pipes, and great balls of fire, and a rickety old mining town. Each chapter of the game focuses on a specific location, ensuring there's enough variety throughout. However, it may be the Parisian-themed levels that reign supreme, simply because it feels nice to smash things up amid European opulence, and it's where those killer nutcracker puppets look most at home. That contrast is, after all, what gives this game style, and sets it apart from the rest of the pack. The juxtaposition of deadly clockwork automatons with the delicate fancy finery of Belle Epoque Europe, and all this infused with a dark gothic flavour and strong hint of alchemy. As discussed in a previous video, this is epitomised in Alchemist Bridge, a literal fusion of European architecture with alchemical symbology. In my opinion, the game loses some of that style in the more archaic environments. The bulb-lit signs of the theatre district, the golden statues of the opera house, and the Art Nouveau banners of the Grand Exhibition make up the main attractions. All levels are afflicted with copycatitis to some degree, but it is easier to overlook with the fancier landscapes, where the textures are lusher and the colours richer. Much has been written about the game's difficulty, and the frustrations at the hands of brutal boss design, but it's easy to forget that this game, like the era that inspired it, offers a wide range of sensory pleasures. Smashing Puppet is plain fun, especially when you finish off a bulky enemy with a special move, and their massive frame explodes, each limb blown out of their socket. You feel fine doing this because they are just puppets after all, or hulking furnaces on legs, or hideous carcass monsters. The sound design is similarly satisfying. Blocking an attack with a perfect guard elicits a chunky clink and sparkly particle effects. The enemies are nicely varied too. It's demonstrated by those prototype robots in Vanini's factory who don't have their heads screwed on the right way. The haptic feedback packs a punch. Ambushing an enemy from behind is accompanied by machine-like rumbling from the controller, like a motorbike revving its engine. Farming for Ergo, the game's currency, can turn into a meditative experience, as you seek to dispatch the smaller enemies in record time, then quickly stagger the bulky enemy to finish them off with an earth-shattering blow. Then there's the collectibles. Weapons and armor are secured in chests that crack open with a spark, while side quests reward the player with soulful jazz records, decorated with Art Nouveau-style labels. Listening to records boosts your character's humanity, as does responding to character dialogue in a humane manner.
Really? What a relief!
In this version of Pinocchio, line is rewarded. It's quite easy to tell which is the better dialogue option, because usually when you're not telling the white lie, you're just being downright cruel. Returning to Hotel Krat, the game's hub, offers a chance to unwind, listen to a jazz record or two, and converse with its inhabitants. Each character has its own story that can be fully explored by completing side quests. These are relaxed, simple distractions, a much-needed diversion after toughing out an end-of-chapter boss. There are cryptic vessels to be found, which require a puzzling mind, nothing too taxing, mostly a pleasant distraction. On the subject of difficulty, this was my first time playing the Souls-like. It took me just over 40 hours to complete the game, including all side quests and bosses, and finding all those quartz pieces you use to upgrade character abilities. Would I recommend this game to a casual player? I would say yes, with reservations. To relay one's frustrations, I would recommend doing some research beforehand to understand how the game systems work, as these aren't all that well explained within the game. Namely, it's best to level up your stats according to the weapon in hand, and it's better to plug your upgrade items into a single weapon, rather than spread them scattershot throughout your arsenal. Once you have decided on the playstyle, you may as well fully commit. Boss fights aren't all that difficult when you come equipped with throwables, a spectre to aid you in battle, and a friendship wishstone. The most difficult fight for me was the very last one. I counted 6 attempts. There were strategies you can use to essentially put the game on easy mode. Still, even with all this in mind, this is a relentlessly brutal game. The YouTube comment section can attest to that. There were people who felt physically and mentally broken by this game. Others who said they couldn't wait to finish it just so they would never have to see it again. By the end of the final chapter, I did start to question whether I was actually enjoying the game. The final chapter is an uphill slog that could, in my opinion, have been half as long. To me, it felt more a test of patience than skill. You meet the same rapier-wielding enemy, walk the same thin rafter flanked by the same annoying gunman, meet the same disruption-dealing devil dog. In later levels, you are constantly blighted by status effects, such as decaying disruption. For the less skilled player, this just means waiting a long time for status bar to go down before setting on the next group of enemies. This not only disrupts the flow of gameplay, but also discourages a forward style of combat. I found myself constantly running away from enemies to a safe spot, before attacking them from behind like some yellow-bellied coward, just so I could reach the next area relatively unharmed. An effective strategy, just not all that fun. One could argue that the final chapter is in keeping with the crucible-like nature of a Souls-like, a definitive test of might for only the most worthy of heroes. At the time of writing, the number of Xbox players who achieve the best ending is less than 3%. This would suggest that many players simply gave up. It would be interesting to see if this figure increases with time. After all, this is not a game to be completed in a few sittings, especially if you're a newcomer. I found myself enjoying the game most in short bursts, gradually mapping out one area after the next, as if piecing together a giant puzzle. Taking on the final chapter in one marathon sitting, I would not recommend.
I trust you. Let's keep going.
Boss fights kick your heart into your mouth. Even the smaller bosses are capable of inspiring abject dread. Kudos to the designers who make every fresh encounter feel truly hair-raising. The game uses jump scares to hurl enemies into the player's path. This sometimes feels a cheap trick, but it also allows new mini-bosses to introduce themselves with great panache. Puppets move with a jittery awkwardness that makes their attacks difficult to predict, adding to the tension. Similarly, mutant enemies throw in an extra swipe after their combo has seemingly ended. One of my favorite late-game enemies, a rotund wooden Pinocchio toy, jumps about like a bouncing ball and spins the player around in a bear hug before smashing them to the ground. The pain of being on the receiving end of such attacks is blunted when the animations are so gleeful. End-of-chapter bosses are preceded by brilliantly creepy cutscenes, shot through with cinematic flair. Watching the King of Puppets whirl his accordion-like arms around the Opera House floor is a delight, even if you are getting smashed in the face by them. For a game with such a silly-sounding premise, it boasts a surprisingly serious story. This is a grim, dark fantasy, which calls to mind Game of Thrones not just in its choice of names, but also its penchant for killing off main characters. Genius inventor Vanini is a dashing Italian dandy who provides some much-needed comic relief.
We still don't know if the frenzy arose by the King of Puppets, or if someone else is pulling the strings. No pun intended.
But as you learn more about his backstory, you realize that even this seemingly happy soul is burdened by a deep-seated tragedy. You uncover character backstories by completing side quests. In most cases, the twists feel fairly commonplace, as you learn how character X is unexpectedly related to character Y. However, the voice acting is good enough to make you care.
Sorry. It's just so sudden. I need some time to think.
The overarching story is cleverly entwined with the game's mechanics. Characters you meet early in the game make more sense once you have gathered information about them, through documents, conversations, and the odd audio recording. This means that much of the story is only truly understood in retrospect. It may not be enough to make you want to replay the game, but it may just inspire you to rewatch cutscenes and reread notes in your inventory. The cryptic storytelling is where the writing shines brightest. The late game invites you to piece together fragments of memories to build up your protagonist's backstory. By the end, once the dust had settled, I found myself grown curious about the more mysterious aspects of the game.
You're a legendary stalker.
Ugh, so annoying. Germany, get rid of them. I'm off.
On the other hand, there is a lot of waffle to sift through. Vanini begins a shot of limoncello and ends a bucket load of grappa, so to speak.
And here I go again. Blah, 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 and who cares, huh?
And don't get me started on the King of Riddles. I would rather stick my ears in the blender than endure another of his rhyming couplets, so to speak.
Correctly or tango with danger, but when you quiz with the king, danger's no stranger.
And then there's Sophia, whose countless pleas to save Krat made me question whether she was one of those talking dolls with a pull string on the back.
Save Krat, save Krat, please. Save Krat.
In short, a little less conversation, please. Which all leads to the question, is this game fun? While the boss fights are a thrill ride, it's hard to deny the rush you get from dealing that final blow. Exploration is fun the same way piecing together a puzzle is fun, except each piece has razor-sharp edges. Fun just might be too strong a word. It's fun like studying clockwork. You marvel at the craftsmanship and how all the pieces fit together. But you also get annoyed when the gears get stuck, and the second hand jumps back and forth, and by the end you are just pleased you got the thing ticking in the right direction. It's an impressively built machine decked with lots of satisfying flourishes, and I'll leave it at that.